Hi, I'm Kathy Maranti, and this is Inspiration for Life Guideposts, February-March 2024. Let's begin with Editor's Note, written by Edward Grinnan, Editor-in-Chief. The Power of Love. Last fall, I released my latest book, A Journey of Faith, A Mother's Alzheimer's, A Son's Love, and His Search for Answers. I must thank you for your response to my story. I worried that a book about my family's experience with Alzheimer's and my own fear of the disease would not deliver the hope you expect from guideposts. But I was wrong. As one reader said, this isn't really a book about Alzheimer's. It's a book about love. A mother's inescapable love. Maybe that's why I find her love in so many of the stories in this issue. In our cover story, Bill Courtney extols the power of everyday people to do good things. Each of us has a talent that can lift others up, he says. Mom helped found the Furniture Resource Center in Pontiac, Michigan, where she persuaded people to donate good used furniture to inner city families. And Mom was persuasive. Michael Thompson's story, Three's Company, shows us that where there is love, there is always room for one more. Mom agreed to take in Blanche, my father's impoverished cousin who needed a home, even as Mom was raising four children, one with Down syndrome. Legendary college softball coach Patty Grasso came to understand that loving her players more than winning makes a true champion. My mother loved her sports teams, win or lose, as I do mine. In Someone Cares, readers share three sweet acts of kindness anyone can do, which again reminded me of Mom. Once, driving down Telegraph Road, she saw two boys hitchhiking in just t-shirts. It was cold, but she was forbidden to pick up strangers. She went home, pulled two old sweatshirts from my brother's closet, drove back down Telegraph, and somehow managed to hurl the sweatshirts out the open passenger's window without running the boys over. That was her unflinching kindness. She said they reminded her of me. The power of love, as Bill Courtney says. We can all do our part to help create a kinder world. The upside, quotes from today's positive thinkers. Don't let anyone interrupt your faith. The people who say, but what if, don't listen. When people discourage your dream, it's only because they don't dream as big as you do. Jennifer Hudson, actor and singer, on advice she'd give her younger self. Prayer cuts through all our superficiality, right down to the heart of getting real about our need for God. This is where grace abounds. Reverend Adrienne Donhauser, who stands outside her New York City church weekly with a sign, "Ask me for a blessing. God's grace is meant to be shared." Sometimes the thing that makes you feel the most self-conscious turns out to be your greatest asset. Cindy Crawford, supermodel, who once wanted to remove her distinctive beauty mark. If you find something to be grateful for, then you find something to look forward to, and you carry on. Michael J. Fox, actor, 62, on his life with Parkinson's disease. Only when we have the courage to own our history are we able to write a brave new ending to our story. Brené Brown, author. People always tell me, you're the luckiest person in the world, and my response to that is, it's funny how the harder I work, the luckier I get. Jose Hernandez, 61, who was a migrant farm worker as a youth and later became an engineer and a NASA astronaut who went into space in 2009. Implicit in Jesus' commandment to love our neighbors as ourselves is the assumption that we are supposed to love ourselves. We are supposed to be kind and gentle, caring and nurturing, empowering and forgiving of ourselves. If we are unable to do this, ultimately, we may be unable to do it for our neighbors. Shaniqua Walker Barnes, theologian and psychologist. My mom has been telling me since I was a kid, it's not about proving others wrong, it's about proving yourself right. There's power in that. Steph Curry, NBA great, on how he deals with criticism. It's not the worry. It's not the what-ifs. It's the joy that stays with you. Sandra Bullock, actor. Love is not a thought, though we think about love a lot. It is not an emotion. Emotion is how we experience love, but it is not love itself, just as the scent of a rose is not the rose. Love is a state of being. Edward Grinnan, author of A Journey of Faith, A Mother's Alzheimer's, A Son's Love, and His Search for Answers. I find that when I help someone else, All my problems seem to disappear. I don't want you to think they go into thin air, but when I'm helping someone else, I get help for myself too. Opal Lee, 97, civil rights activist. Surrender is the strongest, most subversive thing you can do in this world. It takes strength to admit you are weak, bravery to show you are vulnerable, courage to ask for help. Holly Whitaker, writer and speaker on recovery. Spirit lifting. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of His glory. Isaiah 6:3. Snow fell right along with the setting sun, the flurries creating an old-time movie effect, dancing across a sepia-toned world. Photographers often refer to dusk as the golden hour, when lighting is at its finest. Dusk also happens to be the golden hour for spotting God's creatures. As we drove down a country road, my husband noticed the silhouette of a great horned owl perched on a cottonwood branch. Then we saw a second great horned owl in the next tree. A mile later, we discovered another pair. A bit farther was a lone fifth owl. I can see God orchestrating these golden hour moments throughout my life when circumstances are perfectly aligned for me to witness His grace. Glory sightings become all the more plentiful as I learn the conditions in which they're most apt to be revealed. Just as the golden hour takes place every day, God's activities in my life are regular and consistent. What's important is that I step outside my regular routine to see them. Lord, remind me to accept your invitation to watch you at work in the world. Thank you for the golden hour moments you send to grace my life daily. Erin Linium. Someone cares. Pass it on. Messages with heart. Last February, I came across some heart-shaped sticky notes in fun colors on clearance. With Valentine's Day only 2 weeks away, I bought them, knowing I'd find a good use for them. That night, one of my roommates made us a delicious dinner. Before bed, I wrote, "Thanks for dinner, you're a great cook," on a note, and stuck it to her bedroom door. I wrote a second note to my other roommate, saying how much I'd like the dessert she'd made. The next morning, both of my friends were so thrilled, I decided to keep writing notes. Each day until Valentine's Day, I decorated their bedroom doors with a sticky note that described something I appreciated about them. "You're such a great friend," one note said. "You make me laugh every day," said another. My roommates looked forward to seeing the colorful notes, and they made our apartment look cute, too. I saved the extra sticky notes so I can leave them for family members and coworkers this February. My sister, who's a nurse, is taking the idea to work, too. She plans to leave notes on the doors of her patients' hospital rooms to brighten their day. Written by Julia Sontag, Terre Haute, Indiana. A few simple words. I was telling a friend how proud I was of my daughter for stepping out of her comfort zone. "Have you told her? She probably needs to hear that," my friend said. How right she was. After my husband Eugene died unexpectedly, I had to learn how to manage the finances and maintain my car, two tasks he had always taken care of. It was intimidating. The first time I met with our financial advisor, he said he could imagine Eugene looking on from heaven, feeling proud that I'd overcome my fear. Those words brought me such a sense of peace and accomplishment. I realized I needed to offer my daughter and other people that same gift. Now, whenever I say or think something nice about another person, I make sure to say to them as well, "I'm so proud of you," I say, then tell them what a great job they did or how brave they were. "You should feel proud of yourself too," I add. I want to encourage people to feel good about themselves and their accomplishments. Those few simple words might make a big difference, just as they did for me. Shirley Eukert, Marathon, Wisconsin. Thinking of you. I walked into the house exhausted after my overnight shift as a truck driver. All I wanted to do was crawl into bed. My wife, Wendy, works as an educator, and as always, she needed to leave for her school before I returned home. I went into our bedroom. The bed was made, and the covers on my side were folded down in an inviting way. I couldn't help but smile. Wendy was so thoughtful. I got a good day's sleep. Then it was time to head back to work. Unfortunately, I would have to leave before Wendy returned home. It was tough not seeing each other during the work week. I went to pack my lunchbox and saw that Wendy had made sandwiches, turkey and Miracle Whip, my favorite, and left them in the fridge for me. I grabbed a piece of paper and wrote a note thanking her and telling her I missed her. I left it on our bed, where I'd folded down the covers for her, just as she had done for me. Even though Wendy and I work opposite schedules during the week, we stay close by leaving little reminders that we're thinking of each other. Written by Kevin Owens, Fort Worth, Texas. The power of everyday people. His message is simple. We all have something to give to help others. Written by Bill Courtney, Memphis, Tennessee. 20 years ago, one small decision changed the course of my life. A buddy asked if I'd do some volunteer coaching for the Manassas Tigers, a high school football team here in Memphis. 2 weeks for spring training, he said. I'd played football in high school and coached the sport for a living during my first 2 years out of college. I ran a lumber company and had 4 kids, but I figured I could spare 2 weeks for a good cause. The school was in a lower-income part of the city, and the football team was at the bottom of its league. 2 weeks turned into 6.5 years. I got so inspired by those hardscrabble boys, I became head coach and helped them reach the playoffs for the first time in school history. A documentary film crew heard about the Tigers' comeback story. The resulting movie, Undefeated, won an Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature. I became a celebrity overnight. I was interviewed on TV and profiled in magazines. I even wrote a guidepost story about how my player's grit inspired me to do something I once thought impossible, forgive my father, who had walked out on my family when I was 4 years old. God used an off-the-cuff decision to change my life and the lives of countless other people. I've often wondered what motivated me to step up and volunteer. Everyone has a list of what they think is wrong with the world. Fewer people actually do something about it. What if we could change that? Since the release of Undefeated in 2011, I've written a book about leadership called Against the Grain and traveled the country giving talks and meeting people. My latest project is a podcast called An Army of Normal Folks. It's about everyday people who decided to do something about the problems in their communities. My theory is that if we could assemble an army of people like that, we could fix a lot of what's wrong in our world. I've learned something from the many inspiring people I've met on the podcast and around the country. It turns out that the answer to my question, what makes people decide to help, is pretty simple. In fact, I've developed a handy formula. People serve when their passion meets their discipline at a moment of opportunity. My own story is a perfect illustration. I had a passion for coaching because it was my coaches who mentored me after my dad walked out. One of my disciplines is football because I played and coached for years. All it took was an opportunity, my buddy asking me to volunteer to get me going. Maybe you see needs in your church, school, community, or elsewhere. It's easy to talk yourself out of helping. The problem is too big. What could someone like me offer? I don't know how. I find that when passion, discipline, and opportunity line up, those barriers fall away. Let me introduce you to a few of the people from my podcast, and you'll see what I mean. It might surprise you how easy it is to join the army of normal folks. I encourage you to give it a try. Barrier 1. The problem is too big. Arshe Cooper grew up on the west side of Chicago. In the 1990s, people described his neighborhood as a war zone. A kid got shot outside his high school. It seemed as if everyone ended up in a gang. One day at lunch, Arshe saw a long, slender, 8-man rowing boat set up in the middle of the school cafeteria. Ken Alpart, a Chicago options trader eager to prove that rowing wasn't just for rich white kids, was recruiting for a new team. Like most kids in his neighborhood, Arshe didn't even know how to swim, but the team was offering up free pizza and a cute little girl he liked signed up, so he did too. The first day of practice, Arshe found himself sitting in a skinny plastic boat in the middle of a lake with kids from rival gangs. Some of them were so terrified, they cried. Gradually, he and the other kids learned to row. The sport forced them to put their differences aside, work together, and overcome skepticism that a bunch of black kids from the west side could compete in rowing. They didn't win a championship, but we won by proving we could do it, Arshe says. With his newfound confidence, Arshe attended Le Cordon Bleu Culinary School and became a successful chef. He wanted to give back to his community, but he didn't know how. The problem seemed insurmountable. I watched kids die, he told me during our interview for the podcast. I stepped over blood to get to school. My mom was addicted to drugs. Sometimes my siblings and I had to scrounge for food. It's asking a lot to expect us just to tune it out and focus on school. Arshe thought back to the day in the cafeteria. Rowing changed my life. Maybe it could change others. Arce volunteered with an organization that encouraged disadvantaged kids to row. He coached teams and started similar programs in other cities. He wrote a memoir about his high school crew, A Most Beautiful Thing, which was later made into a documentary. He now runs a foundation that helps establish and equip inner-city rowing programs. To date, the foundation has introduced rowing to more than 3,000 kids and provided $450,000 in grants and equipment. Arce credits God with introducing him to rowing and showing him that he didn't have to solve every problem to make a difference. When his passion met his discipline at the opportunity of urban high school rowing, he discovered that he already had enough to give others the gift that changed his life. Barrier 2. What can someone like me do? John Ponder faced even greater challenges than Arce Cooper. He grew up in the Bronx, where he joined a gang, became addicted to drugs, and was arrested for the first time when he was 12 years old. Eventually, he was incarcerated 3 times on felony convictions. The only bright spots in his early life were the summers he spent at his Grandma Medea's house in Meridian, Mississippi. At Grandma's, you went to church, no questions asked. Fast forward a few decades, John was in prison, awaiting sentencing on his 3rd felony. A preacher shoved a Bible through a slot into his cell. Out of sheer boredom, John read it. It didn't take long before he was on his knees praying, God, if you're the God my Grandma Medea believed in, I will accept whatever sentence the judge gives me. But if you inspire that judge to go easy, I will spend the rest of my life serving you. John was facing up to 23 years in prison. The judge sentenced him to 5. John used those 5 years to learn how to start an organization that would help prisoners re-entering society. That's exactly what he did when he was released. John runs the Las Vegas, Nevada-based nonprofit Hope for Prisoners, which provides recently released inmates with comprehensive reentry support, including job training, character development, and mentorship opportunities. A hallmark of the program is its protocol of pairing many clients with a mentor from local law enforcement. John says it still moves him every time he sees newly released prisoners meet their law enforcement mentors. All the barriers and mutual suspicions drop away as these guys learn to see each other as human beings. John could have looked at himself, gang member, recovering drug user, felon, and said, what does someone like me have to offer? In God's eyes, John's own experience with reentry was all he needed. What did he have to offer? Himself. What does God see in you? Remember, when you combine what you care about with what you know how to do and look for an opportunity to serve, God will bless your efforts. Barrier 3. I don't know how. Amy Crenshaw of Jackson, Tennessee, was used to cooking for a crowd. She and her husband, Jim, a doctor, felt called by God to adopt and had a large family. Their 9 kids included 2 adopted from Ethiopia and 4 from China. A decade ago, Crenshaw's oldest daughter was doing mission work in downtown Denver when she discovered the Same Cafe. The restaurant's name is an acronym for So All May Eat. The cafe served a small menu and charged whatever you can pay. How did such a business survive? The owners found that when you treat your customers with kindness, they not only return the favor, but extend that kindness to others. Generosity and community break out all around. Amy felt inspired to start a cafe like that in Jackson. Her kids were growing up, and she wanted to be part of reviving her city's downtown. One problem, she'd never run a restaurant before. That would have stopped a lot of people. Amy picked up the phone, called the owners of the Same Cafe, and asked how they did it. Turned out, she knew more about serving food than she thought. Remember her busy kitchen at home? Since 2013, the Community Cafe in Jackson has been serving a small, pay-what-you-can menu of healthy soups, salads, and sandwiches to everyone who sits down at one of the long wooden tables. Homeless people, judges and lawyers from the nearby courthouse, families, tourists, business people, you name it. This isn't my cafe, it's the community's cafe, Amy says. We just rely on people to be generous. When they walk out feeling satisfied, we know we succeeded. By now you know the drill. Amy's passion to help her community, combined with her cooking know-how, which then took off when her daughter told her about a new kind of restaurant. What do you care about? What do you know how to do? What opportunities are waiting in your community? You don't have to be an extraordinary person to join the army of normal folks. You just need those 3 basic ingredients. Well, those and one more. I'm sure you noticed that God was there when Arshe, John, and Amy decided to act on their desire to serve. He was there for me, too, when I decided to become a coach. Give him your passion and your discipline, and he'll be there when you come across that opportunity. Trust me, it will change your life. Mysterious ways, more than coincidence. When I was 5 years old, my ears were pierced with golden wire in a small ceremony, as was customary in my native India. At that time, my family lived in Agra, in the northern state of Uttar Pradesh, in a house with no windows or central heating. The seven of us all slept together in one room. After dinner, we would sit on our beds beneath the mosquito netting and pray the rosary. We were among the less than 3% of Indians who were Christians. One chilly winter night, my mother brought the portable coal stove inside to warm the house. My siblings and I chatted until we fell asleep. A couple hours later, I woke with a start and screamed out in pain. One of my earrings had gotten caught in the mosquito net and was twisting my earlobe. My parents woke up, but were too groggy to stand at first. My father hobbled to the door and pulled it open. As fresh air filled the room, he told us that carbon monoxide from the burning coal had built up. Then he looked at me and said, "Our whole family would have perished if your screams hadn't woken us up, Putha." We offered up prayers of relief and thanksgiving. 2 winters later, my family took an overnight train to another state. We were fortunate to have a compartment just for us, but it was very cold. As the conductor punched our tickets, he said, "I am sorry to see that you are shivering, even in your coats." After a while, it seemed to warm up. The rhythmic clickety-clack of the train wheels against the tracks lulled us to sleep, and I drifted off with my head in my mother's lap. Just as I had 2 years before, I woke and cried out in pain. My earring had become hooked in the folds of my mother's sari. My father struggled to sit up. He fumbled with the latch on the window and managed to open it. We gulped in cold air, realizing that carbon monoxide had filled the compartment. It turned out that the conductor had placed a small portable coal stove in the outer section of our closed compartment without telling us of his kind gesture. We wept with relief and thanked God for keeping us under his protection and once again using my little gold earrings to save us. Although I wore the same earrings for several more years, they never got tangled on anything again. Rita Vaz, Houston, Texas. Answered prayers. Thank you, Lord, for the meeting last night. Talking through some of my problems helped clarify things. I also got a new book to read, and my priest advised me a new way to pray. I feel good so far and hope it continues. That was written by Angela. Praise the Almighty God. My daughter passed a crucial teaching exam. Only one left. Carolyn. My prayer that my husband's immigration case be documentarily qualified has been answered. God is good all the time. Juan. Thank God our small business got some new customers. Lisa. Miracles and healing. The author's long, dark night of the soul led to a different kind of Easter miracle. Lifted. Written by Roberta Messner, Huntington, West Virginia. Past 3 o'clock in the morning, 2 weeks before Easter, I sat in the darkness of my car, parked in my driveway, feeling as if I were going insane. I'd been awake all night. I couldn't stop twitching, moving, grabbing at myself. My mind raced. Bad voices clawed the edges of my brain. I tried everything I could to stop them. Racing up and down my attic stairs, doing frantic jumping jacks, bicycling my legs in the air. But it was hopeless. On the streets, they had a name for what ailed me. Dope sick. At 64, I was in withdrawal from opioids. For 28 years, I'd been prescribed OxyContin for pain relief. I have a genetic condition that causes invasive, non-cancerous tumors to grow on nerve cells all over my body. I had undergone 34 surgeries over the years to remove the worst of them, but the tumors that remained caused me constant pain. At first, the OxyContin was a godsend. It allowed me to keep my job as a nurse and live a normal life. But my town in Appalachia had been gripped hard by the opioid crisis. My insurer stopped paying for the OxyContin. My doctor said new insurance rules required me to enroll at a pain management clinic for a new prescription. A specialist there took me off OxyContin entirely and put me on a new, weaker medicine for nerve pain to be taken every 12 hours. It'll help you more than the OxyContin did, the specialist assured me. You might have some withdrawal symptoms as you go from one drug to the other. They shouldn't be too bad. The past 3 days had been hell on earth. I'd been taking OxyContin for a long time, although I never deviated from my doctor's instructions, and she tapered me off slightly before I quit cold turkey. I'd built up a strong dependency. Deprived of OxyContin, my body panicked. It ached like a giant toothache. Pain signals coursed up and down my arms and legs. I called the clinic. I was told to tough it out. How? I shook with chills. My skin felt as if insects were crawling all over it. I couldn't keep anything down. Worst of all, my mind buzzed with bad voices. They taunted me endlessly. It's going to be like this forever, Roberta. You're going crazy. There's no point in trying. Just give up already. No one else knew what I was going through except my sister, Rebecca. She'd come to stay with me after I left the pain clinic. I sent a brief email to friends in my writing group asking for prayers because I was going through a rough time, but I kept it vague. I was ashamed of my dependency on OxyContin. What would people think? No one loves you. Even God's left you. You're all alone. Not sure what else to do, I banished myself to my car in the early hours of the morning. It was usually the place I did my best praying. Now that I was here, though, I couldn't think. I could barely get Jesus' name out. I had too much trouble breathing. I was going to die in this car. God, where are you when I really need you? Have you totally left me this time? The dashboard clock told me it was 4 o'clock. A piece of advice someone had told me ages ago came to me. It's the friends you can call at 4 a.m. who really matter. I thought of my dear friend Sue. Her husband used oxygen for a lung condition. Maybe it would help. We usually talked every day, but I hadn't heard her voice since this whole withdrawal thing. She'd probably been calling, worried sick. I hadn't checked my voicemails, emails, or mailbox for days. I dialed Sue's number on my cell and told her my situation. Come right over, Sue said. I'll get the oxygen set up. Rebecca drove me to Sue's house in the cold black night. Sue tucked me into a makeshift bed on her sofa and got the oxygen. I breathed it into my greedy lungs. She parked her chair by the sofa and massaged my agitated legs. Within minutes, I was no longer starved for air. I began to relax. 3 hours later, I woke up to the smell of coffee and Raisin Toast. I'd slept for the first time in days. Sue fixed up the guest room so I could stay with her as long as I needed. The pain and panic persisted. I didn't know how much longer I could survive. I thrashed wildly at night, hitting my head on the brass headboard. Sometimes I awoke to the sound of Sue playing Easter hymns on her piano, convinced I was hallucinating. Then, 4 days before Easter, something changed. I awoke in the middle of the night with the most bizarre feeling, as if I were being held, wrapped in a giant hug, safe and secure, buoyed by some force, as if I were being lifted up somehow. Tentatively, I listened for voices. They were still there, but they were different this time. You're going to make it, Roberta. Don't be afraid. You aren't going to just survive. You're going to thrive. This new medicine is going to work wonders. I felt strong, confident, courageous. It defied all logic. I grabbed my journal and wrote down everything I was hearing. These voices, they weren't mine. The pain didn't immediately subside, but I knew without a doubt I was going to be okay. On Easter morning, I awoke to Sue practicing the piano again, singing the hymn, He Arose. I zipped up my jacket, poured myself a cup of coffee, and found my way out to the front porch. It was daylight. I climbed into Sue's big wicker porch swing and listened to the birds singing. Across the street, I could see a woman planting flowers as her husband washed windows. Yellow and white daffodils had pushed their way through the wintry soil. Pink dogwoods were in glorious bloom. It had been ages since I'd seen or contemplated such things. I thought again of the voices, the good ones, now running through my head regularly. There's nothing to fear, Roberta. You're going to make it. I knew this time I would. After 10 days at Sue's, I was well enough to return home. As I rejoined the living, I finally listened to my voicemails read my email, and collected the big stack of colorful envelopes and packages from my mailbox. I hadn't told a single soul outside my inner circle what I was going through, and yet many dozens of people had prayed for me anyway. "I sensed you were in crisis, Roberta," one friend wrote. "I'm praying for swift healing." "I felt moved to pray for new pain relief for you," another friend emailed. Wanda in Montana had placed a lovely lace handkerchief inside healing passages in her Bible, prayed the verses, and then tucked the handkerchief inside a gorgeous card that she sent me. Peggy and Mike in upstate New York mailed me a comfort blanket they'd prayed over. Karen in Georgia had been pausing by a bush of red roses every morning to talk to God specifically about me. The prayers got more and more specific. "I suddenly felt you need God's peace, Roberta. Lord, I'm praying that you be with my friend and comfort her. Dearest Roberta, I knew you were in trouble, so I gathered my entire church, and we were anointed with oil and prayed for you." Readers of my stories that have appeared in Guidepost magazines and books wrote in too. "I found your address online and had to write to say that I am praying for you," wrote a woman named Pauline from Michigan. "I sense you are in difficulty and am asking God for your healing from pain." The prayers went on and on. I went back and checked the dates on the messages, then compared them to the dates in my journal. They were all dated a few days before Easter, the very time I had the feeling of being inexplicably held. "It's the friend you can call at 4 a.m., the advice went. I had called, the greatest friend of all, and his network of followers had answered. That's all we have time for today. I've been reading from Inspiration for Life Guideposts, February-March 2024. I'm Kathy Moranti. Thanks for listening to Chris.